This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Do you say and do things when drinking that you regret the next day? Is alcohol a problem for you or someone you really care about? Over the next hour, we'll find out how people just like you and me found sobriety in AA through sharing their experience, strength and hope. Welcome to AA Live, brought to you by Alcoholics Anonymous.
Kia ora te whanau. Welcome to the Alcoholics Anonymous AA Live Radio Show. My gosh, it is the 1st of April. Did anybody play any pranks on you today? My son did, which is pretty standard in his world, but I hope that you didn't get confused by anything out there on this April the 1st. Welcome to the Alcoholics Anonymous Show, as I've said. It is lovely to have you around the motto this evening and out around the world, I should say. Those that are listening from afar that we know about, we appreciate the fact that you're out there. Thank you. We have got a wonderful interview this evening that I have done with Joshua, and I'm hoping that you're going to get some good insight into his story. He was wonderful to chat with, really enjoyed it. But firstly, I'd like to talk about our daily reflection today, and it being the 1st of April, that is the beginning, well, it correlates with step four. So made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, which is also the daily reflection today. It's called Looking Within. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That's from our 12 Steps and 12 Traditions book, page 42. Step four is the vigorous and painstaking effort to discover what the liabilities in each of us have been and are. I want to find exactly how, when, and where my natural desires have warped me. I wish to look squarely at the unhappiness this has caused others and myself. By discovering what my emotional deformities are, I can move toward their correction. Without a willing and persistent effort to do this, there can be little sobriety or contentment for me. To resolve ambivalent feelings, I need to feel a strong and helpful sense of myself. Such an awareness doesn't happen overnight, and no one's self-awareness is permanent. Everyone has the capacity for growth and for self-awareness through an honest encounter with reality. When I don't avoid issues, but meet them directly, always trying to resolve them, they become fewer and fewer. And that's from our Daily Reflections book. I have to say, it's a good one. A lot of people walk into the rooms and they see step four and it terrifies them. Whereas I think the most important step is step one and understanding that our lives had become unmanageable. And so with that, we're going to kick in to the interview while you ponder that reading perhaps and have a chat with Josh.
This is my conquering song, laid on waves so strong. Put the broke down life for too long. Well, this is my conquering song, where only my love survives. A long crawl. All the
It's a wonderful bit of music from our guest this evening, and I'd just like to welcome you. How are you, Josh? It's wonderful to have you here in the studio.
Yeah, good, thank you. Yeah, I'm a little bit tired from the end of the day, but pretty good.
Good. Tell me a little bit about that song. Were you listening to that or something? That's one of your faves? What's that?
I think that's something I literally just kind of came across it. I think I was talking to someone and noticing that the music was getting a bit loud and interruptive, and said, oh, I just knocked that on the head. And then the first few chords of that song started, I was like, oh, hang on a second. I think it was just Spotify kind of playing stuff that I thought it might like, and I did.
Yeah, that's nice. It was really lovely. Mm. Now, we're lucky to have you in here this evening to talk a little bit about your experience, your strength, your hope, as we do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had one question I wanted to start with, and that's, what was your first drunk?
That's a strange question for me. I feel like a lot of my kind of formative years in terms of drinking, or, you know, being a teenager or whatever, they're really lost in a haze. I could not say what my first drink was. You know, I might have sipped the odd like shandy or something, but there was no there's no like kind of concrete memory that I think I have of this was the first time that I started drinking alcoholically or whatever. I do know that I think from the very beginning I was kind of born without a throttle. You know, it was just pedal to the metal kind of thing. I tried a lot of, what do they say in AA, the kind of outside issues. I started a lot of that. And then it wasn't until I was about 18 that I actually started drinking, just because I think it was a bit more affordable than those other things. And I vaguely remember a very sunny day out in a field with a few friends, and I'd somehow bought a whole bottle of vodka, didn't know how to drink. And so I think I had most of it, and they had to kind of drag me home. So,
my gosh, did you poison yourself by chance?
Probably, yeah. So, I think already, although I was hanging around with people that like meets like kind of thing, we all had our own kind of issues. I wouldn't call them alcoholic or addicts, but we certainly played with a lot of that stuff for fun. Already I think I had some sort of a different kind of reaction to alcohol.
Were you a student when you started this?
God, I wouldn't know. I think I might have been in college or something. So, yeah, potentially. I do remember it went from, I could notice that all my other friends, you know, they were quite heavy users, but I just had something that was a little bit more personal. The party never stopped for me. Everyone else could kind of call it a night and go home, whereas I went until things were, finished, bottles were finished or whatever it might be. So already I think I had a sense that there was something slightly different about the way that I used them. But honestly, it was all fun and games. I had a really good time for a long time. I think my childhood, as I hear a lot in the rooms, was a pretty tumultuous. Both my parents had no issues with drugs or alcohol or anything like that, but they were mental. I love them now, and I've got a really good relationship with them now, but yeah, mental health issues. So I was grown up in this kind of malaise of those issues, and I was really suffering. So I think the moment that I struck off with my friends and started playing with all these mind-altering stuff, I took to it like a duck to water. I almost feel like I think I might have shared in the past, something I might have overheard somewhere else, but the feelings of getting drunk for the first time was this sense of like a deep, warm hug, and everything in the world just felt okay for a while. And that was a really a strange feeling from the feeling that everything was not okay, deep sense that I wasn't okay and that the world wasn't okay. So I feel like in a strange way, I really don't think I had much of a chance when it came to becoming an alcoholic. Although it was quite a few years before I would start to say that I really had a problem.
I was going to say, when did the hug stop hugging?
Yeah, when was the party over? I think that honestly, I dragged myself out for years and years. I had a host of kind of fair weather friends that we all did the same kind of stuff together. This is, I'd moved from the UK at that point to New Zealand, and I think I tried one semester at Auckland University and I dropped out and just started drinking very heavily and doing all the other stuff. And I think I went on for, I suppose if I try to count, probably about 15 years where I drank and used quite heavily. But the time when I can honestly say that things got really, things were hectic, you know, there was the absolute nonsense of the things that we used to get up to and the disasters we used to get ourselves into, but it was all still quite fun and amusing. And there was definitely a sense that we all pined for it really quite hard. So there were struggles around keeping ourselves topped up all the time and affording things, but it was mates looking after mates, and there was always a beer to be had somewhere. I think the part where it started to get really dark for me was when I moved away from that friend group, noticing that there was no way that I was able to have any sort of traction in my life. I couldn't get any job to work. I couldn't get any relationship to work. It was always just this chaos of living hand to mouth and drink to drink. And so I did a geographical, I guess. And I didn't really understand that at the time, but I tried to move away from these friends.
Did that involve moving towns?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, mm. Yeah. So all of that occurred up in Auckland. And so really out on a whim, I followed my sister down to Dunedin. She was moving in, going to try and doing something similar probably, but going to move in with her boyfriend. And, things exploded. But essentially, I stayed in Dunedin. And that's where I've found it really hard by that point to meet people and to have any, you know, connections, and ended up for quite a few years, I think about 4 years of where drinking became very insular. It always had an air of that to me. You know, I drank alone quite a bit, but this is where I solely drank on my own. And I...
Weird question. Did you find moving to Dunedin, the student culture helped you be able to easily access alcohol and...
Oh, really? I don't think so at all. I think even now, you know, I'm a student, but I don't see any of it. There's almost like I live in a completely separate world in the university than the Castle Street parties or whatever. And, you know, I lived in Northeast Valley at the time, and that's pretty studenty. But I don't think it had any influence on it. It was, like I was saying, it was very insular. It was all hidden and all on my own. Maybe I'd go up to the gardens and I'd drink up there, but it was always on my own. So I don't think I really noticed any influence from the studentville or anything like that. But yeah, there was an awful lot of just kind of, I suppose what ended up happening is, and it's something that I feel like a lot of newcomers get to this point where it's all fun and games, it's all really nice, and then there's the absolute daunting feeling that now I'm trying to stop. I'm actually genuinely, for the first time in my life, trying to control or stop my drinking, curtail it in any way, and I couldn't. And that was like the feeling of vertigo, standing at the edge of this cliff. I had this kind of danger that I was living with all my life, kind of living on the cusp. But yeah, feeling the weight of that issue when I suddenly realized that I was powerless, I guess, and I didn't have words for it then. It just freaked me out.
Yeah, I thought I was going insane because I just couldn't stop and I wanted to.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Everyday battle it was.
Yeah, and, I think my life got really slow back then. It really did start to revolve around when was I going to drink and how much money did I have and kind of scraping things together. But I kind of always found a way, and I drank alone in my room, and it was very depressing.
We're very resourceful, aren't we, as well?
We
have no money, but we still manage to accomplish that.
Yeah, I think the cheapness of some of the beers that were on offer, very strong kind of 7 or 9% things that I guess were fortified, they're just kind of scrounging dollars together for that. I guess I feel like, you know, I spent a long time on you know, anti... antipsychotic drugs, you know, like kind of antidepressants. You know, I genuinely was just so, it's hard to almost connect with those feelings anymore, just so bleak. The outlook on my life was just nothing. I just felt like constantly, I might try this thing and that. I'd try going to Polytech, I'd try this. I don't know, I always had all these zany ideas as to how I could kickstart my life or do something. And I just felt that every year, every month, every week, I was just slowly spiraling. And my life was just kind of getting more and more uncontrollable. And, you know, on the surface, I might have even looked okay. I really tried to play up that I was doing all right with flatmates and maybe my family as well. I had a car, I had a place to live, paid the rent.
Yeah, on the outside, you were looking like any other normal person, but inside you were in complete turmoil.
Yeah, I think that's something that really strikes me. I remember my sponsor and me talking about step one, and this is way back. And he was talking about the unmanageability. And yeah, there's the unmanageability of waking up and, you know, you don't know what you've done, a bit of a blackout and the room's a mess or whatever it might be. That happened a lot to me. That was, you know, really obvious sense of unmanageability. But for me, the bit that really struck was when he talked about the internal unmanageability. And that's really that incredibly dark place that I find myself. And it talks about it in the big book, the jumping off place. I honestly thought that alcohol being a fatal malady for an alcoholic, I think for me it was probably going to be a suicide. It wasn't going to be a long drawn out liver failure. You know, then again, maybe it would have been, you know, resourcefulness.
No, I completely relate to what you're saying, and that's one of the lovely things of being in this position of people coming in and talking, and I get this privilege of hearing the story and the similarities. And I was the same. It was not going to be a long drawn out thing. I felt I was going so insane that the best way to stop it would be immediately rather than just drink myself to death.
Yeah. And I definitely had some pretty close call run-ins with psychiatric teams and stuff like that. The psych warden just in the hospital. Pretty bleak moments in my life.
Isn't it interesting how we there's not many of us that I meet that aren't on some medication, antidepressants and so forth. And, of course, the signs are always on the packet saying, do not drink. But not once did it occur to me, and this is the insanity of the disease, that these aren't working for you because you're drinking.
I mean, the idea that the alcohol is literally a nervous system depressant. Cognitively I knew that, but in terms of, I suppose the thing is I could steal elation through it. You know, if I had every day was pretty dark. So when I finally kind of pressed the I can't care anymore button and finally started drinking in a day, could be noon, could be 5 p.m., doesn't matter. I could kind of rob a little bit of happiness. You know, I remember sitting in my room on my own. And I'd have a great big box of beer, and I thought, you know, everything's going to be all right. I'll watch something funny online, you know, comedian or whatever, and I chuckle away to myself. I think I've explained it in a way. I don't think it's a very logical way of explaining it. It works for me. It's like I was always living in arrears. I was basically stealing happiness and contentment from the future and just dragging it into the present because the present was so painful. I just needed to medicate. I needed somehow to get out of my head. The feelings were so intolerable. I would do whatever it took, you know, the drinking. For brief moments, it would be okay. But therein kind of lies an issue because alcohol stopped becoming so reliable. I remember, you know, some of the bleakest moments I think in my life were when I was depending upon alcohol to feel okay for a bit, and it didn't come. And I was drunk, and I was unhappy. And I don't know quite how to convey just how awful those moments were in my life.
I think you're conveying them incredibly well. I can relate to what you're saying. I'm sure some of our listeners out there will relate to it as well. I don't know if you recall this, but I remember you in your first meeting.
Oh, do you? Oh, wow. Again, you know, I don't remember my first drink. I don't remember my first meeting, but I've heard secondhand from people like you and a few other members in the fellowship that, I don't think I looked all that well.
You did not.
No.
The person that's sitting opposite me right now, completely different to the person I saw in that first meeting.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did see your desperation and I did see your willingness. And so it's been a real pleasure watching you blossom and keep coming back, you know, because you did.
Yeah.
You kept returning and returning and you were quick to, well, felt like you were quick to get your sponsor and you listened and you did what was said.
Yeah.
You might not remember that. But
no, I really don't, but I remember everything in my life seems a little bit hazy, all that kind of period of time. I've talked to my sponsor and apparently I hung around AA for about 6 months before I did anything. I had no concept. You know, I might have related my story previously, and the way that I'd rewritten it in my mind was that I just kind of slowly got it. But certainly the timeline that he says versus, you know, my timeline, I tend to believe him absolutely, was that I dipped my toes in AA for about 6 months. And I think that was the torture. You know, I tried so many things to try and get a handle on my life and my unmanageability and my alcoholism. I tried self-help books, you know, it lists the things in the book. And I remember first going through that and it really made me chuckle because I tried so many of those things. It was this controlled drinking for an alcoholic is just
it's a myth.
Like a torture. And it was to say, you know, all sorts of silly things, health farms, sanitariums, or, you know, all of those. We could increase the list.
Yeah,
ad infinitum.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really did. And so I had this list of all these things that I should try. And I don't know why, but AA was at the very bottom of that list. And I think I went to, I think Monday night was the groups I first started kind of getting a hold of. And I would go to meetings and I suppose I felt some sort of connection, a deep connection, but I balked. That's a word that I learned from the Big Book. I balked so hard. I saw all this wellness and I the idea that people could live a useful life sober. And for some reason, it took a long time to sink in. But I remember going to meetings and it would highlight the kind of chaos and I suppose it was coming up against wellness. It just really highlighted my unwellness and had these huge deep senses of shame. And I would go away and I'd have to lean on the only thing that I knew, which was drinking. And so quite often I'd leave the Monday night meeting, which was at the time was in the community house, and I go straight to freaking Countdown, and as if like other members probably didn't notice that, but I go there and I get, you know, get whatever I needed for that night.
Well, other members may have noticed, but other members have done that too.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I can believe that. Yeah. It really did take a while for me, and I think it's something that I really need to keep into my mind that how long it sometimes takes for different people to actually just feel comfortable in the rooms for the first time. Because it took me a long, long while. But I feel like the first unbelievable act of providence in my life was that those first meetings, of all the meetings I could have gone to, the Monday night meeting is now my home group. It's one of my absolute favorites. And the guy in the corner of the room who told, you know, elements of my story so eloquently and so intelligently and had what I wanted in that kind of, I could tell he had the disease. He had the exact same kind of need and want and emptiness inside of him that he needed to fill with something, you know, whether it be drugs, alcohol, or God. he had the same malaise as I did, and yet he was well, just so truly well. Confronted as I was by that, eventually, this person, I plucked up the courage to ask them to be my sponsor. And again, I think I dragged my feet on that. That took me weeks of thinking about it and not doing anything about it and feeling the shame afterwards. But yeah, eventually I did. And he, to my confusion, he said yes immediately. And yeah, I've been my sponsor ever since. And I think the idea that I almost feel like this person could not be the most perfect sponsor for me.
Oh, I think he's the perfect sponsor for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know, you actually came into the Monday lunchtime meeting.
Oh, did I?
Yes, and we said to you, you should go to the Monday night meeting.
Oh,
there are people your age group. You should pop in there. There's some good people for you. And you did. That's where your journey began. Oh, wow. And I just think that that's wonderful. Mm. Yeah, as I say, it's been an absolute pleasure watching you.
Yeah, yeah. I think that some of the things that absolutely confused me about, just going back to the kind of the harrowing nature of the story, the part I remember reading later, years and years later with my sponsor, parts of the Big Book, going through with them, and hearing bits of my life finally starting to make sense when I hear them through the Big Book. And it's kind of that sense that you were talking about before, about feeling like you're going insane. And it's the tiniest little bit of the Big Book that I've actually somewhat, if I try it off the cuff, might be able to memorize. But it's the idea that, I think it says we're unable at certain times to bring to mind with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, that we are without defense against the first drink. And that small kind of phrase just kind of blew my mind, and there's several places in the Big Book that kind of did that for me. I think the where it talks about the 10th step as well really kind of does that. But the idea that's the kind of the mental obsession for me, that absolutely, the two caveats that make us an alcoholic, the physical disease, the physical obsession where we're kind of, I'm getting them muddled, the physical kind of allergy, they kind of call it, but the idea that once I have that one drink, there's never going to be enough, or at least more like all bets are off. I don't know whether I'm going to have that one drink, call it a night, go to bed really early, or wake up the next morning in a heap, and have a blackout. I just had no idea. I was powerless over what happened to me once I took that first drink. But then, the bit that really, I suppose this was the insanity, of the first drink, the thing that freaked me out the absolute most was that I knew in the deepest sense of my being that another drink and another spree or whatever it might be was not going to make me better. And yet I had the yearning and found myself almost magically with a drink in my hand or with the desperation that it was the only thing that could solve my problem. And stuck in that sense for years, that's the kind of thing that I feel like was making me go absolutely insane. The ability to have any sort of life preservation, that those kinds of instincts were just gone. And I was doing the very thing that was killing me to make me feel better. And that's that dark place where I can't quit alcohol, but I can't live without it. And that's the kind of the absolute bleakness that I feel like was getting me into AA. And it was what you were saying before. You saw that desperation. That was the gift, of that desperation, that I'd gotten to that place where in the very deep sense, I think I intuitively knew that I was that powerless over alcohol. And that something really drastic needed to happen. And those were the kind of impetus to be able to start working in the program, or at least do the very bare minimum, like you say, go to the meetings and then eventually reach out and get that sponsor. But then, that's the beginning of my kind of recovery journey. I was going over the Big Book just, the other day with my sponsor, and every now and then just kind of quizzes me on where I'm at with understanding some of the key concepts. And he was like, he was trying to remind me of something that is just so hidden in plain sight almost. I think he says it maybe in the Big Book it says it, but it certainly says it in, I think it's the, when it talks about step 7 in the 12 and 12. Apparently, completely hidden to me is the idea that the three tiny, or tiny, the three small things that we need as a kind of foundation of being able to have some sense of getting the program. And it comes up with the acronym of, what's it, WHOM, apparently. So willingness, like you just said, honesty, and then the next one's hyphenate, open-mindedness. And, you know, that was just hidden to me, you know. And this is coming up like 4 years reading the books and being in there. These really basic fundamentals are kind of I'm still oblivious to.
Well, it's that getting out of your own way. That's what it is. Just move aside, listen. Learn, be honest with yourself, and take in the similarities, listen to what you're hearing. And do you know, it actually just gets bigger and bigger and more clearer the longer it goes. So what you're saying right now is saying, oh, gosh, you know, it never even occurred to me that was sitting in plain sight. Once you see it, you can never unsee it. It's like when you go into your first meeting, and someone says, you've got an allergy. You know, this is what it does to us. And there's a whole bunch of people in a room saying the same thing. It messes with your drinking. So it's already planted its first seed. And then it's just such a beautiful program that slowly grows. If you let it, if we water it, feed it, and, you know, yourself as a botanist, you know, this whole concept of watching you sprout and flower, and I mean, that's what you've done in front of us. It's beautiful.
I feel like that. I think slowly starting to have this enormous compassion for newcomers, and also a patience, because now knowing, you know, just how long it took me to get any semblance of a manageable program or workability of a program, and then start to actually get well from doing the steps and working with a sponsor. That's kind of giving me these kind of insights into the amount of patience that we need and the amount of kind of nurturing that we need. But yeah, I think I've heard some of the great speakers or members of our fellowship talk about their sobriety. And I remember even back in my early days, the way that they would talk about it. And being someone that kind of enjoys plants, I suppose the analogy really struck with me. But yeah, they nurture their sobriety like a garden, you know, like a beautiful kind of garden. And you know, it can be as simple as like pruning away parts of our character that are still maybe a little bit too spiky or whatever. and then the weeds, removing the weeds, these kinds of defects of our character. But also celebrating the beauty of this kind of this gift from God as well.
And it is a gift, and it is a beauty. Not saying that there's not an occasional tornado that comes through and gives us a pushover and so forth. I've had one myself this week, and I was talking with my sponsor today, and it's all learning at the end of the day, and the best thing is that I haven't lost my willingness to do that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think that's the thing that I find so beautiful about the program is I came in with that very low bar of I don't want to die.
But I will keep doing this.
Totally, yeah. And I just needed some help with my drinking. And yet what is actually on offer in AA once you get sober is that kind of true wellness, this deep sense that you can live with yourself, nurture your flaws, get better, and just, what do they say? I think this is right towards the end of the big book, grow in usefulness and effectiveness. And that's at carrying the message, but in all sorts of other avenues of our life.
And every aspect of our lives, actually.
Yeah, totally.
And as you get more wellness, your growth expands, and then there's more things that there's more plants that come into your pot and your garden, and you watch them grow. It's an amazing program if you do the work. The strange part is that, well, this is for me, when we come in, well, I did not even think I needed that much work, but boy, oh boy.
Totally. Yeah, I think I really relate to that. I think the beauty of this the situation that I was in, I ended up being in therapy for quite a few years before I quit drinking, but I've continued working with that therapist. And also my sponsor has a lot of insights there and a lot of experience there. So in terms of being accountable to my constant growth, as well as that as a mental health and also a spiritual kind of sense. But yeah, I have these profound daunting moments where I realize just how unwell my thinking still is. But even though my impulse still can be to revel in the gloom of it for a day or so, I have the tools now. I have the tools and the people around me, the support network that allows me to do this constant growth. And I hear really, really long-term sobriety people talking about this. That there is no plateau, there is no place to be reached. There is just this constant working on yourself, and it, working is almost not the right word, because it's not so difficult as that.
I think it's progressing in life.
All these kind of phrases are coming to me, but the idea in the big book, towards the end, it talks about trudging the road to happy destiny. And I remember talking with my sponsor about this, and I think he was in one of those meetings where they studied the big book alongside a 1930s dictionary.
Talk about this.
Yeah,
yes.
And he was saying apparently the word trudge has kind of changed in meaning. It means to us now, you have someone trudging through the snow, whereas what it used to mean is more like the idea of to walk with purpose, to place each foot with purpose. And I really, really like those kinds of ideas. And that's what I feel like I'm doing with this constant growth, that it's not begrudgingly. It's this idea that I can get well, and I can get well and then be able to be more useful and effective in other avenues of my life, but certainly, hopefully, in AA, and being able to transmit this message and pass on the gift of recovery to other people. And I feel like, that's the absolute bright spot of my life and of the program, is now having this tiny amount, this amount of sobriety that I have and this wellness that I have, this superpower. And it's a superpower that even newcomers can have. Someone who's got 2 days sobriety can help someone who's got 1 day sobriety. But the idea that one alcoholic talking with another can maybe do for what I genuinely had the experience with, that years of work with a therapist couldn't do, that I got well in a way that is unbelievable in maybe a few months, when years of kind of pretty decent psychotherapy failed to. And not to dig on psychotherapy, I feel like sobriety and those kinds of works, they go hand in hand and favor each other.
The difference too is the way in which you were looking at that therapy and how you were approaching it, and your ears were open to it. I had exactly the same experience, I'm still with my therapist as well, although we don't meet weekly anymore.
I can't afford them weekly.
And I have such a huge respect for this person who has helped guide me through that, and that goes with my huge respect for the people in the fellowship as well. You started off talking about the hug, and I have to ask, just closing in on this one, the hug, do you realize now that you get it from somewhere else?
Yeah, absolutely. Just as you were kind of saying that, it got me, my brain was kind of going ahead. And I think that's the thing, that the void or the hole in the soul that I had for so many years, I feel like slowly but surely gets filled up with the spiritual awakening. And, that's the process of doing the 12 steps has given me a sense of well-being that means that I no longer need outside kind of things to bolster my mood or whatever it might be. Basically, God has filled that hole. And I think all along it was a God-shaped hole. And I can speak so easily of that now, but I just kind of thinking about what I was like as a newcomer, I was very embittered around the concept of God, and that in AA, that we offer a spiritual recovery. Those were all just kind of absolute balmy ideas, and I thought it was absolute nonsense.
You're not alone there.
Yeah. It seems to be something that people find extremely difficult, despite the obvious nature of our kind of flaws and our unmanageability. But I'd given up on God. I'd given up on all of that kind of nonsense. And I suppose my experience with it these days, and I feel like it will grow and shift. But at the moment, I am done philosophizing around God. I know that it is functional for me. And as an alcoholic, I do things for effect. And when my sponsor first said, you know, have you prayed on it? You know, get down on your freaking knees and pray. I thought that was absolutely impossible. I needed help right now. Can't you see? I'm suffering. And that slight crack of the door of the open-mindedness and being willing to do something that I did not think was going to help. And then slowly but surely, I've built up a practice that is really quite, you know, compared to the catastrophe and the difficulty of general life as an active alcoholic, it doesn't ask much of me to take small times out of my day to connect with a higher power and do what I need to do to stay sane, to hand over my life.
It's not even anywhere near the time it took for us to partake in our addiction.
Yeah, to crack a bottle. Or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
But that sense of relief that it offers me is profound and so much more different than anything that I could ever have reached in active. I remember even early on, I think I might have only been a year or so sober, and I had one of those. You know, it probably when I say it, it probably sounds really trivial, but it was one of those unbelievable kind of aha moments for me. I think I was out walking a flatmate's dog, and most of my life in early recovery was pretty painful. You know, I'd given up the crutch and I hadn't quite found God yet, so I was just white knuckling my way through sobriety. But I went down and I think I was in the Woodhall Gardens by the Leith River, and it's kind of sun was just right, and I just kind of looked about and everything was okay. I had this unbelievable sense of well-being come upon me from nowhere, that was so much more beautiful than anything I feel like I could have reached with drugs or alcohol. And it was very, you know, it was fleeting, but more and more my life can access those kinds of...
That's your first moment of peace that you've just described to us.
The serenity was slowly coming.
How beautiful.
And yeah, I didn't need to seek that through anything outside of myself. That it came through some sort of external something higher power, and you know, slowly but surely, those behaviors in terms of making conscious contact that I didn't want to make, and a habit that I've formulated, and all these other kind of uncanny moments in recovery, a lot of them happened through doing step 9. Have given me this very workable relationship with a higher power where I don't want to question it anymore. And I just
is.
Yeah, I have a deep sense of just okay with it. Mm. It's totally just functional. And it's like what you hear of old timers, that the road gets narrower. I had no idea what that meant. And maybe more and more as I go along, I will understand more. But for me, it just means that I need to do these tiny little things in the day to make myself okay, and it's the small kind of suggestions in the big book, taking the daily inventory, you know, talking to a sponsor, if I'm wrong, promptly admit it, handing over my will and my life, all these little things that I don't know, maybe sound ridiculous, but
they work.
They just work. They release me. They release me from the sometimes painful places, and it gets me closer and closer to those moments of serenity. It's much more reliable than drugs and alcohol. That's the thing. And so as an addict or alcoholic, I do things for effect, and I know that this works. And again, in terms of moments of serenity, another one of those kind of pivotal moments in my recovery, I think, was I was unbelievably lucky to have I've somehow been asked to become a sponsor when I was about 2 years sober, which seemed really strange to me. I was just lucky, basically. But upon working with this person, first off, I was just nervous. I had this kind of baton to pass on of recovery, and I just didn't know that I was going to be able to do it. And I worried that there was something about me that wasn't going to be able to convey it, not understanding that this is a God job, that God works through me. But I just remember these moments of leaving a long session of working together, reading the big book, studying the big book, and the overwhelming sense of relief and okayness that came from knowing that at that point, in that moment in time, I was doing exactly what my destiny was. You know, what my higher power wanted me to do was to give freely of myself and to transmit this message. And the overwhelming peace that comes upon me, that it says again in the big book, this is the kind of crux of the program, the gift that we think you should not want to not have, or, you know, not experience. Is the beauty of the program is being able to convey this message. And yeah, those small experiences for me, they're the bright spots of my life. And I suppose even saying that out loud now, I would maybe have cringed at that in active life at that time was just this vessel where I wanted to suck every tiny amount of pleasure and satisfaction out of every moment and every bottle, every bag. I just needed to squeeze. And something as simple and prosaic as brief little moments in a car or on a river that give me this sense of well-being, I would have thought that they're cheesy or that they're just not good enough, but they're so much more profoundly good enough than anything I think I could have come up with back then. I feel like I'm slowly but surely turning into the person that I could have been if I had never been interrupted or interfered with, and slowly awakening up to the kind of destiny that God has in store for me, and trying less and less to be judgmental or demanding upon what that might be, to try and go with the flow of things as opposed to forcing myself to go somewhere.
It's beautiful. You've conveyed your journey with us in such a profound way, and I think the listeners are going to cherish that. And I hope they listen for those similarities and the strength that your words have given us tonight. It's been a privilege to sit here with you and have this time with you. Thank you so much for coming in and spending time with us.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Jen. I really appreciate your service and the time you've taken with me.
Same with you. And we're going to finish with one of Joshua's picks, and I think we'll go with The Sun in the Morning.
Awesome. Yeah.
She feeds me daily soul. She drinks right to my soul.
You're listening to AA Live on ORFM Dunedin.
Now, if you feel like giving up drinking and you think you might need some help, then Alcoholics Anonymous may be the place for you to be. I can suggest to you to jump onto the website, which is aa.org.nz, or you could call us on 0800 AA Works. That is 0800 229 6757. Now, you'll get one of us on the other side of that phone line. As Alcoholics Anonymous is done purely voluntarily, so all of us in recovery, we donate our time because we would love for other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Life becomes such a different kettle of fish once you find it and you put down the drink. For myself, I can only speak of, it changed my life so much. I have a wonderful life today with great relationships, a brilliant relationship with my son. I have a wonderful job that challenges me. I really enjoy life. If you'd like to jump into a meeting, jump on aa.org.nz and have a look. They have all the meetings listed throughout the country and the times, and they have online ones as well. So don't think you're missing out. Right. It's been lovely to spend the evening with you tonight. Thank you so much for keeping us company out there. Until next time when we see you, matiwa, everybody.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.